Life Audio.
You are listening to The Becca Cook Show with your host, Becca Cook. For more information about Beckett and his ministry, visit his website at beckettcook.com. To help support the podcast, visit patreon.com/The Becca Cook Show. Please consider subscribing to the podcast and leaving a 5-star rating.
Hey guys, welcome to the show. Today I have a very special guest, Casey Diaz. He wrote a book called The Shot Caller, A Latino Gangbanger's Miraculous Escape from a Life of Violence to a New Life in Christ. His story is amazing. When I read his book, there were so many times when I got choked up and I was just like, oh my God, only God could do this. And his story, his conversion story, is absolutely incredible and amazing. And I can't wait for you to hear it. But first, a word from our sponsor.
Well, good day to you. It's Joel with The King Country dropping in to let you know that our brand new film, Unsung Hero, is in theaters now.
It's Luke here. We've teamed up with the creators of Jesus Revolution to bring you this adventure of a lifetime. It's a powerful, true story about a family uniting, growing in their faith, and facing the impossible together.
In theaters now, unsunghero.movie for more information.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
What impacts you every day? There is one book that influences almost every aspect of our lives. Museum of the Bible reveals the Bible's impact on your favorite musicians and artists, the way we measure time, social justice, our national monuments, and more. The Bible's impact is all around you. Discover how at museumofthebible.org/impact.
Welcome, Casey Diaz.
Thank you so much for having me.
So good to have you on. After reading your book, I was just, as I just said, I was just blown away by it. And by, I mean, it's just like God can do anything. He could save wretches like me, wretches like you. It's just crazy to me. And your story of your conversion story is amazing, which we're going to get to. But let's start back in the beginning. You were born in El Salvador. You moved to LA when I think you were 2 years old.
Yes.
And you moved to kind of Koreatown, downtown LA, right?
Yeah, it's considered the Rampart District of Los Angeles.
The Rampart, which was like a very controversial time.
Yes.
And the Rampart Division was very, very controversial. In fact, the show The Shield was basically, I don't know if you ever saw that show, but it was based on the Rampart Division.
They've done several movies and shows about Rampart. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a lot of corruption and crazy things going on. So you came to LA, and then how did you get involved in a gang? Because I think you were, what, 11 years old when you first joined a gang?
Yes, I was 11 years old. Got introduced to it by one of my friend's brother, older brothers. And when I say older, he was probably around 15, 16 years old, which is in the streets and in the whole gang culture, it's pretty up there. It's strange.
It's over the hill.
When you've lived it, 15 and to an 11-year-old involved in a gang already, it's pretty old. And, it was just enticing. I saw, the people that picked him up for parties and the people he hung out with, they were already driving cars. They were already, it looked like fun, to be honest with you. It didn't look like what it became initially. And so that kind of intrigued me in the beginning.
Yeah. And you say in the book that, part of the reason why you joined the gang was because you had a very difficult relationship with your father. Was that kind of the main reason that it was appealing to you to have a group, to belong to?
Yeah, for me, it was a combination of my father being there but not there. He was an alcoholic, a very strong drinker, and a very violent man. And then you had my mom, who was just trying to, pick up the pieces where she could, and working late hours, early mornings. And so I never got to see her except on Sundays. So a combination of those two things, I think, partake of what I would become later on in the future. I was left alone, unsupervised, at a very young age. So I think that does play quite a role in my young childhood.
And so, and you were an only child, right?
At that time, I was, yes.
Yeah. And so you get involved in the in this gang. I don't know if we can say the name of the gang or not. But you get involved in this gang, and there's, you know, some crazy things go down. And when you're 11 years old, I think when you were, I don't know, how old were you when you entered juvenile hall?
It was 11 years old. It was almost immediately after joining the gang at 11. I'd say maybe several weeks, maybe a month or two.
And what were the charges? What was the reason why they put you in juvenile hall?
I don't remember that far. I think it might have been a robbery, armed robbery or something like that, very early on. And followed up by a stabbing and some more violent crimes at a very early age. Yeah.
Yeah. And what was that like when you first entered juvie hall? What was that like for you? I mean, were you scared, or was it just kind of like that was just part of the gang culture and you just were expected to kind of do that?
You know what? there's a funny story behind that, because you hear about so many, police officers would tell you as they're arresting you, oh, you know, this is going to be horrible. You're going to, you know, people get raped, people get killed in there. You hear it all, right? And so that's what you're expecting. And I get there, and I'm sitting in the reception center of this juvenile hall, East Lake Juvenile Hall. And it was just me and another kid. He's sitting in front of me, and he says, "Where are you from?" In Los Angeles and in the gang culture, when somebody's asking you where you're from, they're asking you what gang you're from. Well, yeah. This guy wasn't asking me in a very threatening way. It was just kind of, "Where are you from?" A very friendly, "Where are you from?" And my mind was already fixed on the first person that hits me up, because that's what you call it when somebody says, "Where are you from?" My heart, my mind was already fixed. The person that hits me up, I'm just going to roll on them. And as soon as he asked the question, I start swinging at him. And it was just like automatic. And so juvenile hall became a very fun playground for me. I didn't see it as a punishment or I felt like, all right, well, this is how you get up in rank. This is how, you know, you make it in here. This is how you make your name known, both inside and outside. So it was more of a playground for me. I know others I've had different difficulties in there.
Yeah. And then, so how long were you in juvenile hall?
I was in and out of that place. You know, the laws were different back then. I mean, I would go in there for armed robbery, for assault, for whatever. And I'd get out within days. Sometimes I would get out the same day from the police stations. It was a different time. I mean, there was times where they let me go without a parent picking me up. And that was, I know it didn't happen just to me. Many people have come forward and said that, you know, the right thing was for a parent to come pick you up at a police station. But there was times where they just let you go. And I experienced a lot of that. It was just a different era, I believe, in policing.
But then when you were 16 years old, you were convicted of second degree murder, and that's when things really shifted. And that's when you went off to prison, right? When you were 16?
I was 16. Yes. I was 16 years old, and I was charged with a second degree murder of another gang member.
And was that, and then in prison, you became what the book is called, a shot caller. What can it explain what that means? A shot caller.
A shot caller is someone that is very high in rank. What happens inside in the California Department of Corrections or in the county jail, they have what's called a shot collar. And various sectors of the prison and pods or modules in the county jail always has what we would consider a representative or a gang leader, a shot caller. That person...
Basically, you're calling the shots is what it is.
You're calling the shots. And it could be from anywhere from what gets moved from one module to another module, whether it's drugs, contraband of whatever sort, and up to, killing somebody while you're in there. And most of the shot callers don't even have to get their hands dirty. You say the word and it's done. It's that quick.
We'll be right back after this short break.
What impacts you every day? There is one book that influences almost every aspect of our lives. Museum of the Bible reveals the Bible's impact on your favorite musicians and artists, the way we measure time, social justice, our national monuments, and more. The Bible's impact is all around you. Discover how at museumofthebible.org/impact.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in... Anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
And how did you get chosen as the shot caller?
I had a big reputation already coming in from the streets. I had a pretty infamous name out here, and that rolled in there with me. When I hit the county jail in maximum security, one of my victims was there from one of my assaults. And this is a guy that I had stabbed in the eye from a gang in Los Angeles. And so his homeboy was there.
With a screwdriver, right?
Yeah, with a screwdriver to the eye.
That sounds pretty gnarly.
It was. And, you know, it's I was introduced to stabbing somebody with a screwdriver initially when, and I talk about that in the book, and mm-hmm. how that just progresses throughout the entire 8 chapters of the first book, that it becomes almost like a name for me. Because of what I did and what I chose to do with. And so in this county jail, in this maximum security county jail, this guy comes up to me and says, hey, you're Casey from, you know, mentioned by gang. And he says, I was there when you shanked my homeboy in the eye. And he stretches out his hand and he says, good to meet you. And that was a big factor in me being brought in as a shot caller and voted in by the rest of the people in there.
Yeah. And then you said maximum security. So I think you were 18 years old when you were transferred to New Folsom, which was a maximum security prison. And I was so shocked by, first of all, you were in solitary confinement, right?
Yes. For 3.5 years.
So 23 hours of the day, you were in a tiny cell.
In an 8x10 cell. To give you a picture of what 8 feet by 10 feet looks like, measure any parking space in any parking lot, and that's about an 8x10. You know, toilet and sink, metal toilet and sink, concrete slab, a sheet, white boxers, white t-shirt, and that's all you got.
And that's what I did. I was so shocked by that they only gave you boxers and a t-shirt. Like not even pants or anything else, just a boxers and a tee.
Boxers and t-shirts and a little toothbrush about this big. just the bristles and a roll of toilet paper. That's all you had. This is solitary back then was solitary. There was no another inmate with you, another cellmate. There was no TVs. There was no, you know, now solitary confinement. You look at the California Department of Corrections throughout every prison here. They have TVs. They have cellmates. And they looks like a liquor store inside their cell. That didn't exist back then. It was absolute solitary confinement.
What I didn't really get in the book is I don't know if maybe I just missed it, but why you were put in why were you put in solitary confinement instead of just with, you know, the general population?
Well, so I went from East Max in the Los Angeles County Jail in Wayside, and then I would be transferred to the gang module, and the gang module held all the high ranking gang leaders from Los Angeles. In fact, it was deemed so dangerous in this module that even regular gang members that were, you know, trustees, and trustees are these are the guys that are probably didn't pay their parking ticket or, you know, lower crimes. And they're only going to serve about maybe 5 months, a month or two. So they're called trustees. And these are the guys that their job is to go serve food in modules, in dorms. They mop up, they clean up, various jobs mm-hmm. to these trustees. Trustees would, and these are gang members, they did not want that job in that module. Because if you came into that module, you were going to walk out with a letter of some sort, an assignment of some sort that could get you in big trouble if you don't do it. And so the point system that they have in CDC, where it's you're labeled from 1 to 100, you're graded depending on your gang leadership, your crime, your name, what we call our jacket. So if you had a heavy jacket, meaning a list of crimes, you were a known individual inside and out. That's how they ranked that 1 through 100. The higher you scored, the more security was deemed for you. So I went in there with 97 points out of 100. So that meant from the bus to the SHU program, no stops in between kind of thing.
And from your book, I mean, you say that a lot of guys in solitary confinement, they go crazy because it can make you completely psychotic and go mad.
And this is what a lot of the folks out here don't understand. It doesn't matter how tall, how wide, how big, how muscular. That has absolutely nothing to do with a grown man breaking down. Those walls do start to cave in. And if you don't have a strong mind, to this day, and I've been out for a long time, there's times when I go into deep sleep, wake up in a sweat. I could hear the voices and the shouts and the yells of somebody that just lost their mind. And, 6'4", 18-inch arms, didn't matter. It'll crack you. It'll mess you up big time permanently.
Wow.
That was solitary back then.
And then while you were in solitary, an African-American woman was doing kind of prison ministry, and she walked by your cell and said, "Jesus is going to use you." Now tell us about this woman and what was your reaction when you heard this from her?
When I the initial, Jesus loves you and he's going to use you, I immediately thought this lady, she has no clue of where she's at. She has no idea who I am. In fact, the CEOs, the correctional officers, encouraged her, or rather discouraged her, from approaching myself. She just had this boldness. At that time, I didn't understand what gave her this boldness, what gave her that, this brave heart to approach someone like me and in their cell. But her words were, she invited me to hear her and for her to pray for me. And I just didn't want nothing to do with that. So when she says this, Jesus loves you, he's going to use you, I didn't know what to take of that. I just thought she was crazy. And she asked me, we come here on the last Thursday of the month, every month. Is it okay to stop by yourself and just pray for you? And I basically told her, you can do whatever you want, but I'm not buying into your whatever it is that you're trying to sell me.
Yeah.
I wasn't rude. I was just firm. I don't feel that I was very disrespectful, but I was just being, straight up with her.
Yeah. But then you had this extraordinary moment, and I don't know. Tell me how long you were in solitary before. I can't remember. I think it was 3 years maybe when this happened. Basically, you were in your cell and you started to see a movie of your life kind of playing on the wall of your cell. Yeah. What, tell us about that, because that's amazing. What happened in that?
Well, here's the thing. None of my crimes, not one of my crimes, whether inside or out, I have absolutely zero drug offenses. Anything that has to do with drugs, I hated drugs. Never just, did I dabble into here and there from time to time? Yes, but that wasn't my thing. And none of my crimes were committed while using anything. I was on my five. And so in the cell, I'm that same way. I'm not doing drugs. I'm not nothing. I'm perfectly fine. And you start seeing a movie right in front of your face on your wall. And it's playing footage that only has taken place in your life. Caught me by surprise. And I thought, in the book, I talk about one of the guys next to me in the cell next to me. He was a guy that went crazy and thought that he had ducks in his cell. He completely lost it.
Right.
So I thought, this guy has ducks in his cell and I have a movie. This is my moment where I'm about to crash and burn kind of thing. But I'm not weirded out. I know what I'm seeing. And then it kind of cuts and it goes into, I start seeing this guy carrying this cross and I see the crowds. I see that this guy, nobody likes this guy. Whoever's carrying this cross, they're not very fond of this guy. And somehow I can see that whoever's carrying this cross is looking at me. I can't see or make the details of his face. Can't see none of that. But I know whoever's carrying this cross is looking at me throughout the whole time. Gets to the nails on his hands, on his feet. I had never, ever, ever had anybody, not even Frances Proctor, the black lady that came and said, Jesus loves you. She didn't even explain that portion to me. So I'm really looking at the gospel coming to life in this movie on my wall. And since I was about 8 years old, my nickname has been Casey. Everybody calls me Casey. I changed it. We were playing baseball or football. I don't remember what it was. And I just told all the kids, this is when kids still played outside, and there was about 15, 20 of us out there. And I just said, hey, from here on out, you're going to call me Casey. And so that nickname has just stayed with me even till now. My mom calls me Casey. Everybody calls me Casey. So here's this guy getting nails on his hands and feet. And the cross is coming up. And I still didn't understand what was going on. I'm just looking. And I'm kind of weirded out in the sense that I know what I'm seeing. I'm wide awake. It's not a dream. I'm awake. And I'm on my five. And then I hear, Darwin, I did this for you.
By the way, Darwin is your birth name, is your real name, is your birth name.
Yeah.
So you're hearing this guy, you're hearing basically Jesus say, Darwin, I did this for you. I'm doing
and
this.
When he, yeah. When he said that, I could hear his breath leave him. I could literally hear his breath leaving. And it was that point that I just got in that cell on the floor and wept. And I don't know I know now I can explain it. I didn't know how to explain it then, but I know it was this overwhelming piece. And I still, when I go and speaking engagements and stuff like that, I still let everybody know I've been out for so long, and I've been in amazing places. I just got back from Maui not too long ago. Beautiful waterfalls and sunrises and sunsets, lakes, rivers. I love that kind of nature. I have never felt the peace that I felt in that cell. I don't think I'll ever feel that peace like I felt that peace in that cell. Because at that point, I knew that it wasn't that I had done wrong. I knew I had done wrong. Who doesn't know that, you know, killing somebody is the wrong thing to do? You already know that. That robbing is the wrong thing. You know that. Mm-hmm. But in that moment, the forgiveness of God, the mercy and the grace of God, the love of God, pointed to the fact that I had sinned before God, that it wasn't a crime, it was a sin before God. And so that sin became what we read in the Bible as exceedingly sinful. That was the game changer for me. And I remember getting so raw with God. And I don't know, you know, some people might say, you know, well, when I repented, I said sorry for stealing a cookie or sorry for, you know, cutting somebody off. For me, it was different. It was, I just got real with God. And I remember saying, you know, God, I'm sorry for stabbing this person, for stabbing this other person. And it was just stabbing.
You were confessing all of your sins. Like
what I was just confessing everything. And as I did that, it was just this amazing freedom. That I can't just, I mean, it was just amazing freedom that I got to experience in that cell.
And then how soon after that did you get a hold of a Bible?
It took about, I'm not sure exactly how long, it's been so long, but I remember hearing God's voice telling me to, knock on my gate. And when I say gate, it means my door, my cell door. There was two doors to my cell. I knocked on it. A guard happened to be walking by when I did that. And, I asked him, I said, hey, I need to talk to a chaplain. I didn't even know what a chaplain was. But that's what God told me to ask for. So I asked. And this guard, the CO, I couldn't see him, but I know that there was a little sarcasm in his voice, you know, pulling my leg. He didn't say that. He said some other words. And I said, nah, man, I'm supposed to talk to a chaplain. And he goes, hold on a second. He goes, comes back, and he slips this little piece of paper and a pencil about that big. And he gives it to me through the tray slot. And I fill it out. I give it to him. And a few days later is when I talked to the chaplain, and he explained, I shared what I just shared with you guys. And he explained, he opened the Bible. And I mean, he was weeping, man, which caused me to weep. And I didn't even know why he was crying. But, you know, he pointed out in John and showed me the whole crucifixion, and the burial, the resurrection. And it just made sense. And I was able to have a Bible at that point.
Wow. And then you started reading the Bible just constantly, right?
I read the Bible, you know. This is before NIVs or any other translation that was out. Whether they existed, I don't know.
King James.
We didn't have them. We had King James.
Yeah.
And so I had a Gideon Bible, and I just read it. I read it like a normal book, from, left to right. And I remember, initially when I started reading it, I thought, okay, well, it's got to get good somewhere. And then you bump into Leviticus and you're going, what is this? How is this going to help me? Like, this is, it's not making sense to me, right? You have 23, 24 hours in that cell pretty much. You have time. So I got to Acts pretty quick. And it's in Acts where I started to see, oh, wow, this is interesting. This something started to happen in my heart, and the understanding started to take place little by little.
And then you got unexpectedly, you got let out of solitary. Why did that happen?
I know now why that happened. But here's God's voice again. And he says, when you get out, you're going to call a gang meeting with your fellas. You're going to let them know that you have nothing to do with this no more, that you're a Christian. And I thought, well, you know, I'm going to be spending 12 years, 8 months at the minimum in solitary. So that's a while before I could, you know, get a bunch of guys together. And lo and behold, the very people that told me I would be spending all my time in there, my door racks open, my gate racks open. That never happens. That never happens. When I was going to a shower, you slip your hands through the tray slots, you're handcuffed, and you walk against towards the back of your cell. You turn around, you get on your knees, cross your legs, and they come in a team formation, and they chain you. And that's just to go down the hall to take a shower. So my gate racking open all of a sudden was a little, it was an uneasy moment for me. And then for them to say, we don't know why we're doing this, but we're going to put you in mainland, in GP, in general population. Then I understood what God had told me to do. That was a very dangerous call for me to run.
Yeah. And so when you told other gang members in prison that you were a Christian, there was, I mean, that was really hard to read because you were beat up so many different times. Because why did they do that to you?
They were supposed to kill me is what they were supposed to do. And usually they'll send someone from your own gang or something that's very close to you. And that's what we would call a road dog, a best friend kind of thing. That whoever's closest to you is usually the one that has to do the job. And there was our gang was big enough to where there was enough of those in our sector. They send this individual.
And the reason they are supposed to kill you is because you're not allowed to leave the gang.
No, you're pretty much turning your you're turning your back on them.
Yeah,
and that's a very disrespectful move. That's what it's called is it's called throwing out the trash. So I'm the trash, and they need to throw it out. That's how it's viewed in there. And they send this gentleman over to my cell. I remember he came the night before they were going to do this, and he comes to my wicket, my little window on my cell, and he's telling me, you know, they're asking me to throw the trash. You need to change your story. And I said, I can't change my story. It's impossible to change my story. I know what happened to my life. And, you know, I want to tell you, I'll forgive you ahead of time for what you're going to do. And I remember him getting super angry, just very angry, and saying, you know, no, you don't get it. They're asking me to throw out the trash. And I said, I get it. I know exactly that. I know the protocol. I know the politics in here. But change my story. I'm not going to change my story. God has done something in my life, and I can't deny it. And so do what you got to do, but I forgive you. And he stormed off. And the next morning is when I see him again. And in the morning is when chow, breakfast is, you know, you go in a chow, and all the gates rack open at the same time. And here he comes. And I'm thinking he's going to come with a bunch of guys in there, and, you know, stab me to death. I've seen that part, taken of that many times. And so nothing new to me. It was a rough night because I knew that it was going to be done quick. I read, prayed. Was I nervous? Yeah. Was I somewhat afraid? Well, you don't know you don't know how it's going to go down. You know, it's going to be violent. And he walks in and he says to me, I can't do this. But whatever you're doing, I'll roll with you. And he became the first person that I led to Christ right there. So for the next 2 years, I think the anger that they had towards me, they were having fun in the beatings. And we had to endure for 2 years. We had to endure. And not just me, but everybody else that followed after me, or after the Lord, rather. Because some very big shot callers came to Christ through me converting. And so we had to all endure that. But yeah, there was moments where you wake up and you don't know what happened. You don't know what, you know, you don't even remember where you were at. You just know that you're waking up in, you know, in the prison hospital or at a hospital outside of the prison. And you're just, you know, it's brutal beatings. But, you know, through all of that, I felt peace in my heart. And I knew that God had did something to it. And I was okay with that.
And tell us again, how long did these beatings go on with you?
For about 2 years.
Wow.
About 2 years. I probably lost count after 20 something. I don't know. There were a lot.
Well, and they did they ever tell you why they didn't take out the trash? Like why they didn't actually kill you?
I think they were just having fun in that moment. I think that they just enjoyed seeing, you know, us blank out, you know, and pass out momentarily out of a concussion or whatever it was. You know, you have 20, 30 inmates on top of you beating you, and it could be 2 minutes, and 2 minutes is a long time when you have a lot of individuals on, you know, just stomping on your head. I've lost teeth. My mouth is all messed up from prison boots to my mouth. And at some point I'll fix that.
And then you started a Bible study, and you were passing secret notes which you called kites. What were these secret notes? What were you doing with these notes?
So kites are little notes that we would pass throughout the prison, you know, from prison to prison, from yard to yard. And these kites, usually they were used for either hits that needed to be, you know, where somebody had to be taken out, killed, or, you know, heroin had to be moved from one place to another or coming in. So there were assignments on these kites. They were just little letters. And so I used that same system to evangelize. I used that system to, and I would write, you know, a short letter. Hey, so-and-so, you know, Jesus loves you and he wants to use you. And I used what Francis told me, you know, and I'd add a scripture or two. And I knew that if I handed this note to them, this kite, to whoever I was going to hand it to, if they took it, I knew they were going to read it. And through that, within, I want to say a couple of months, I had a group of about 4 to 5 individuals that came to Christ through these kites, and they were very influential. Some of them were lifers. Some of them were serving lengthy terms, all of them for murder. And so, them receiving that kite from me and then coming to Christ, was so powerful for God to show me that, hey, I'm gonna multiply you guys. I'm gonna use this as a platform to bring others. And I started this little Bible study on the yard. And again, you know, the beatings and the whole nine yards. And there was times when we'd come to Bible study, and I'm talking about you couldn't even see where our mouth was because it was just the beating was, you know, our eyes were be busted or whatever it was, our nose was to the side, and we laughed, we praised God, and I remember running into a scripture that says that the disciples went through that, mm-hmm. and they were happy, you know, they went off happy, joyous was the word that is used, and I don't recommend anybody getting assaulted for their faith, but
yeah.
When you go through that, there is that I got to experience, that we got to experience, that there's something special that when you're counted worthy to go through something like that. Right. We weren't victims. We never saw ourselves as victims. We saw ourselves as Christians.
Victors in Christ. I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, so you were sentenced, I think you said, to 12 years, right?
But 12 years, 8 months. Yeah.
Yeah. 12 years, 8 months. But 5 years before the 12, you went before the parole board. And tell us that story, because I like how you, when they asked you, you kind of flipped the script on them, because they were expecting you to give them this kind of answer, but you didn't give them the answer they wanted, or they were expecting. So tell us that story.
It was you know, you go to parole board every year. Some people go to the board every 3 years, depends on your case. So for me, I was already on my seventh year, is when that happened, and 7 years and some change. And I show up. To me, it's going to be another regular board meeting, you know, going to go over your case. What are you doing here on the yard? Are you taking the classes that the court and the state has given you to take? Are you completing those things? That's my mentality. And I was completing everything that they were, had assigned me. And I walked in, and, you know, that starts to happen. And towards the end, one of the parole board members says, why do you think we should let you go? Why should we parole you? And I said to him, I said, you shouldn't. I belong here. I belong here. In fact, I feel that the justice system, in a way, failed my victim, because I should have been serving. I should be serving life in here. I don't expect to go home anytime soon. I belong here. I think that, you know, what I got sentenced to is very minute in comparison to my crime. I don't know how they didn't know how to handle that. It was almost like throwing a porcupine in their hands, because, you know, it's like, hey, what is this, you know? They took a recess. They took me out of the room, and then when I got back, when they called me back in, he says, where are you gonna eat? And I jokingly said, you know, at that time in the California Department of Corrections, they still had three hots, meaning three hot meals in the chow hall. But if you, for whatever reason, couldn't make it to the chow, for appointment reasons or whatever, you would get a sack lunch in your cell. And mm-hmm. And it was a soggy sandwich. It was always horrible. Not that the food, in the chow hall was served by,
it wasn't Michelin star restaurant.
Yeah. It wasn't the Ritz neither, but it was just a little bit better. And so I told him, I jokingly said, well, I'd like to make it to get a hot plate before I get a sack lunch kind of thing. And he says, where are you going to eat tonight? And just like the movies, you know, they slide the paperwork to you. And I couldn't believe what I saw. And they had granted me an early parole. I didn't know how to take it. You know, I know that I didn't deserve it at all. But God had he knew what he was doing with me, and knew that for some reason I needed to get out at that moment.
Yeah. And then you get out, but then the INS arrest you, or they arrest you again, or what happened? Tell us that story about the INS, and then they saw you lead two guys to Christ, these officer agents or whatever. So tell us about that, the INS story.
So I'm paroled. I get back to my cell. I make it to the chow hall, by the way. I eat my hot meal. I get back to my cell, and within 24 hours, they're going to parole me. I'm a free man, right? That moment happens, and I'm walking out with my box to the last glass door. You get reprocessed out. You get new pictures, fingerprinted all over again, and then there's always a long procedure. It's mm-hmm. not like they just open the door. But I'm at the last, all the procedures are gone. They've taken care of that. And I'm on the last glass door. So after this door, it's freedom. And I see two men on the other side of that glass door. And they buzz open the door. And he says, D is Darwin. You know, I said, yeah. He goes, go ahead and put the box down and turn around. You know, put your hands behind your head. And, you know, it stunned me because I didn't know, well, maybe this is another crime and I'm getting rearrested for that. I didn't know what was going on until they told me who they were. And they were INS agents. I was born in El Salvador and I came here. You know, I came here legally with my parent, with my grandma. And so I thought, okay, I guess they're taking that away and they're deporting me. And so they put me in a van, head back with these two agents. I'm chained up again, and they take me to a federal detention center. And I go in there, and there's these two. I get placed in a tank. It's a holding tank. There's a phone booth, a phone on the wall, and there's two Mexican guys in there, and they speak English, a little broken, but I can understand them very well. And they asked me, where are you going? I said, I guess I'm going to El Salvador because that's where I was born. And he says, you got family over there? I said, no, I don't have anybody over there. I don't know anybody over there. I've been here since I was two. He says, you got, you know, your folks out here, you're married, you got kids. I said, no kids, no wife. My mom and my dad are here. But he goes, have you called her? I said, nah, I'm not going to call her. I'm not going to call her until I get wherever I'm going. I don't want to break her heart. And I'm able to sit down with one and we start talking. The cool thing about what the Lord does in this is somebody gave me, and hopefully at some point I get to heaven, I'll find out who exactly gave me these two Spanish Bibles. I don't know how to read Spanish. I can hardly even speak it without making a mess out of myself. But somebody gave me two Spanish Bibles that were shrink wrapped, and I don't know why. When I was leaving my cell in New Folsom, I don't know why I even packed them. I could have just left them in my cell, and I didn't. I put them in my box, and so I start talking to the first one, and within a few minutes, I lead him to the Lord, and the other guy's been listening to the conversation between me and him. Second guy comes to the Lord. Now, when the first guy came to the Lord, I went to the bars, and I asked one of the guys that the transportation guys that came and picked me up. I asked him. I said, "Can you go in the box? There's a Spanish Bible shrink wrap. Can you hand it to me?" So he gave it to me, and then the second guy, the same thing. And I bothered the transport guy again, and he did the same thing. I gave it to him. And a few minutes after that, the most incredible thing happened. That same federal agent that picked me up, that gave me the Bibles that were in my box outside of my the tank. He goes to the bars and he says, "Diaz." I said, "Yeah." He goes, "You got anything in here?" I said, "No, just the box outside there." He goes, "All right, man, you're going out." And I thought, man, they deport you quick in here, man. They don't waste no time, right? They must be have like the plane must be like on the back of this, yeah, you know, this place, because that's quick. And he says, "We made a mistake, but we can't let you go. We can't parole you from here. We're going to have to take you back to state, and the state will parole you." And one of the guys said, "I thought you said you weren't born here." I said, "I wasn't. I'm telling you the truth. I'm from El Salvador." And he's, "Why are they letting you go?" I said, "I don't know. Ask him. I don't know why they're letting me go." You know, and so we're walking this corridor, man, this long corridor, back to the buses. There's a milk crates filled with chains, and this federal agent, as we're walking to the van, the buses and vans are, he says, "Can I ask you a question?" I said, "Yeah, sure." He goes, "What happened back there?" I said, those two Mexican guys just came to the Lord." He goes, "I'm a Christian, and I'm gonna tell you something. I've been here for over 20 years. I've never seen anything happen like that. What I've seen is guys that came to be Christians, and as soon as I put them in that tank, they get on the phone and they're talking to their homeboys, or they're talking about who they're going to go sleep with, partying, and the whole nine yards. They forget, you know, that there were Christians in there. This is the first time I've ever seen that. And as he's reaching, we get to the point where the milk crates filled with the chains are there. He reaches down to get to grab the shackles and the chains to restrain him. And his lip is shaking, man. His lip is shaking. His eyes are so watery, and he's trying to like contain himself, which I'm seeing him do that. I start to, you know, get choked up. And he says, you know, I feel guilty. I feel really bad putting this on you because you don't deserve that. I mean, you don't deserve these. And I remember putting my hands out, you know, because I didn't want them to feel bad. I didn't want him to feel any worse. So I just put my, you know, I gave him my hands, and he started to put the restraints on me, put me in the van. And the cool part is that because I guess he had clearance of me being a free guy now, and they're going to take me back to Folsom, he didn't have to take a partner. He came by himself. So he drove and escorted me back to state prison. And I'm sharing everything that just what God had done in my life and in the life of others and while I was in there. And he is just bawling, man. He is just like weeping uncontrollably as he's driving. And I remember I told him, I said, man, I'm going to stop and I'm going to say nothing to you. You're going to get us into an accident and I'll never make it home kind of thing. Right. And we laughed in the whole yards. It was a great moment. And just seeing God is an amazing God, man. And he has continues to do things with people that don't deserve it. Like you, like me, like everybody else on this green earth, we don't deserve anything. Yet he constantly gives and he constantly is his mercy is new every morning and his faithfulness, man. It's just overwhelming.
Yeah. And so wait, how, just so we, the timeline, when you went back to get reprocessed, how long did that take before you were actually free man?
It was pretty quick. Within the next 24 hours, I was released in the morning. At 7 in the morning is when you hear your name being called on the loudspeaker. And then you're again fingerprinted. The whole night. Oh, yeah, here's the cool part. Maybe I shouldn't share this part for those of you that might want to get the book, because something happens when I get back into state prison. Yeah, I don't want to ruin it because
get the book.
Yeah, I got to leave on a cliff right at that point. But something awesome happens through that, and I'm released the next morning. Yes.
Wow. And that was in 1995, you were released? 95.
Yeah.
Yeah, July 3rd, I think it was.
July 3rd, yeah.
And then you got married, had two kids.
July 3rd.
On July 3rd.
And, a few years later.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. You got married 2 years later. Okay, cool. That's all. I forgot about that. So what are you up to now? What's going on in your life now?
So it's some interesting stuff. You know, the book became a number one bestseller. I was invited to the White House, got on major networks on TV, on primetime, shared my story, promoted the book. Right now they're doing a motion picture film that's connected to the book. It's already in development. An A-list director that I'm under contract, so I can't give out his name. I can tell you that the people doing it are amazing people. Zero Gravity is the production company that's behind it. And so that's happening. I host my own podcast, the Shot Collar Podcast. And I go and I speak, do public speaking in churches, detention centers, high schools, universities, wherever the Lord sends me, I go.
Well, I think Francis Proctor was correct when she said Jesus is going to use you.
She wasn't crazy after all.
Are you in contact with her now?
She passed away 2 years ago.
Oh, okay.
2 years ago. But she was at my wedding. I visited her. I surprised the church, Christ Baptist Church. I went to their church. Didn't tell them I was going. They didn't know I was out. and I showed up. It was a great moment where I got to do life with him. And she was at my, the whole prison ministry that would go in there, they were at my wedding. So, it's an amazing a moment that I got to share with her out here.
That's amazing. Well, guys, get The Shot Caller, the book. It's amazing. It'll blow your mind. And listen to his podcast, The Shot Caller. And thank you, Casey Diaz, for being on the show. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Rick. I really appreciate your time and your warm welcome to your show.
All right. Thank you, guys. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Beckett Cook Show. Your support makes this content possible. All episodes of The Beckett Cook Show are also available on YouTube. For more information about Beckett and his ministry, visit his website at beckettcook.com.
Thank you to the team at Life Audio for their partnership with us. If you go to lifeaudio.com, you will find more faith-centered podcasts about prayer, Bible study, parenting, and more.
I found myself on a ledge, three stories high at some condominiums, contemplating my life and struggling to understand my purpose. Have you ever found yourself on the ledge? My name is Billy Ant. I'm a caring father, mentor, and friend. In my new podcast, Billy and the Goat, I share the life-changing events that shaped who I am today to remind you that no matter how far you've fallen, God can help you get up and thrive. Listen now at lifeaudio.com.